confident in their convictions, and all too often described as simply nice. They were monsters wearing sweet faces. She was saved from responding by the return of Petra. The woman had a sheaf of reports in her hand as she strode stiffly toward them. Her expression remained unreadable as she reached Edward's cubicle. He faced her, looking up, hopeful. And the verdict on the boy? Not good. The child may appear healthy, but his triple helices continue to denature and shed their PNA strands. Worse yet, the process appears to be accelerating. Edward lifted his hands, rubbed his eyes, and sighed out his defeat. So the breakdown wasn't because the boy was sick. As I feared, he's simply rejecting the PNA. He's no good to us, Petra said. But we were so close, Edward sagged. We will keep working, Petra said. Success cannot be far away. And besides, you know they only want females. The boy was doomed either way. Doomed? Lisa stiffened. What are you talking about? Edward, lost in his disappointment, seemed surprised she was still there. Surely you understand that males with triple helices are basically mules. They might live forever, but they are genetic dead ends. Only females can pass this PNA trait to future offspring. No, I don't understand, she said, intending to keep them talking, shifting slowly toward the key card on Edward's desk. You're not going to harm this child. He huffed, swung to a computer, and tapped up a file. On the screen, a time-lapsed video of cellular division appeared. The two DNA strands were colored in red, the single PNA in blue. A couple of additional PNA strands hung loosely in the cytoplasm. As the cells divided, the PNA slipped out of the way, joined its brothers in the cytoplasm. Cellular division then proceeded as normal. Once the cell had pinched into two, one of the PNA strands from each of the new cells snaked out of the cytoplasm and back into the heart of the DNA strand, reforming the triple helix in both cells. Do you understand? Edward asked. She did. She now understood why a male couldn't pass on the triple helix trait. A man's sperm cell contains half of his DNA. A woman's egg contains half of her DNA, plus all of her cytoplasm and everything inside the jelly-like cellular fluid. Mitochondria, organelles, proteins, and in this case, PNA. Because of that, a father couldn't pass on the triple helix trait, the trait of immortality, because he couldn't pass on any cytoplasmic PNA. Only a female could. It's like mitochondria in women, Lisa said. All mitochondria get passed along the female genetic line, from egg to egg to egg. Good. So you understand? She nodded. Then you also understand why we have to kill this boy. She jerked straighter. No. Of course not. Edward sighed. He's a dead end, only useful for research fodder. If we'd been able to return stability to his triple helix by treating his shock, then he would have made the perfect test subject for Petra's vivisection table. His organs divided into artificial suspension systems, perfect for challenging and testing the immortality trait. Better that than waiting decades to study this child's growth. Science can't move that slowly, especially in the face of something as inconsequential as morality. Lisa sat back on Edward's desk, numb with shock. She had labored throughout the night and slowly pulled the child back from death's door, only to meet this end? She had also grown attached to the boy. How could she not, with those big, trusting blue eyes? Petra stared sullenly at the child in the incubator, as if he were a dog who had chewed her favorite pumps. Now he's useless. Another failure. A promising failure. Edward patted Petra on the back of her hand. You can still perform the necropsy. Collect all the histological tissue samples you want. We can still learn much, even from this failure. Enough. She wouldn't let them kill this child. As they focused on the baby with their backs to her, Lisa made her move. Already leaning on Edward's desk, she grabbed his keycard and his desk lamp. She yanked the cord free and swung the lamp broad-armed at the back of Petra's head. The weighted steel base hit her skull, felling her like a chopped tree. The woman hit the corner of the cubicle and tumbled hard to the floor. Edward had started to rise, but Lisa kicked the chair out from under him. Off balance, he fell forward. She used that moment to ram her knee into his nose, smashing it and sending him sprawling. He wasn't out, but he was down, dazed. She dropped the lamp, ran to the incubator, and as gently as she could, removed the cuffs and tapes of the NICU's monitoring leads. Once he was free, she swaddled the child in a thin blanket and carried him close to her chest. She knew the prison ward was a blind alley, as was this suite of labs. The only other true exit was the door through which Robert Gant had entered yesterday. She ran toward it, ignoring the flaring complaint from her swollen ankle. At the door, she swiped the stolen keycard, unlocked the way, and dashed out of the ward. A dimly lit maze of halls and rooms spread outward, looking deserted, waiting to be occupied by Edward's new facility. She'd overheard that much. She picked a direction and ran off blindly with the child, moving as fast as she could with her compromised ankle, thankful the child remained quiet after being fed. She hadn't bothered to dispatch or tie up Petra and Edward. For a very simple reason. She remembered the eye of the security camera following her as she fled. Someone already knew she had escaped. Chapter 36. July 4th, 1:48 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Blue Ridge Mountains.
"Where did she go?" Robert Gant pressed.
He stood in front of a computer in Dr. Emmett Fielding's office, located in the red zone of the underground complex. He had gotten word a few minutes ago from Central Security that Lisa Cummings had attacked two of the scientists and fled with his brother's grandchild. A fist formed. Not out of anger at the woman, but at the thought of his brother. He held his grief in his fist and leaned his weight on it, crushing his knuckles against the desktop, trying to contain that well of sorrow. Flashes of moments with Jimmy sparked in his head. Two brothers riding horseback, their first beer together, playing cards while smoking cigars. It had been Jimmy who held him together after his wife died. He tried to squeeze an entire lifetime into his fist, to hold those memories in check. It was why he had come down here, tinkering with Dr. Fielding on some projects, studying some of the latest neuropod designs, including several truly horrendous war beasts in early development. Anything to keep himself distracted. Robert understood the necessity for his brother's assassination, could fathom the logic of it when it was presented to him as a fait accompli. The greater body of the lineage demanded it, so he had to obey, as he'd always done in the past. But he couldn't escape the pain of it.
"She's still missing, sir," the guard said.
The man's image hovered in the upper corner of the screen.
"There are only a few active cameras in that disused section of the facility." "Then check the cameras in the neighboring zones, blue and orange."
"Yes, sir."
As he waited, Robert brought up a schematic of the estate. The main mansion, the lodge, lay 10 miles away, surrounded by its high walls. Only a tiny fraction of the family knew the facility existed. Even Jimmy didn't know, though he'd gone fishing a few times at a river within a half mile of its outskirts. The sprawling research facility covered 20 acres, occupying an old mine on a remote piece of Gant property, set amid the high cliffs and waterfalls of the Eastern Continental Divide. The Divide, which ran through the Blue Ridge Mountains and across the Gant Estate, split the watershed of the region. On one side, rivers all flowed toward the Gulf of Mexico. On the other, toward the Atlantic. A century ago, a member of the bloodline discovered the old flooded mine. Slowly, over time, it had been engineered and converted into a secret facility, carved out underground
and burrowed even farther over the years, spreading under the old-growth forest and meadows. He stared at the map of the facility. It looked like a madman's Rorschach inkblot, much of it shaded out in gray, indicating unoccupied sections of the lab. Robert remembered better times. During the heyday of the Cold War years, the place had once hosted hundreds of researchers from both sides of the Iron Curtain, all working for the Guild, for the Bloodline. The halls thrummed with excitement, the verve of men and women working at the edge of scientific exploration, and often moving beyond. Robert stared at the grayed-out areas now, eating through the facility like a cancer. Since then, like many American companies, the research projects that had once flourished within these walls had been shifted abroad, outsourced to third-world countries, where no questions were asked, labor was cheaper, and government interference or oversight was non-existent. So this older facility was hollowed out, becoming a deserted cathedral to science, most of it shuttered and shut down. Only Robert's pet project remained, though isolated and adrift. His robotics research was no longer considered by the Bloodline a viable path to extending life, deemed to be too macro in its scope. Instead, everything shifted into the fashionable micro world of stem cells, nanotechnology, and now DNA manipulation. Only lately was that trend reversing, the pendulum swinging back with the advancements in robotics, creating the new field of neurorobotics, the merging of man and machine. Still, the Bloodline relegated his work to weapons research, which wasn't inappropriate. In Afghanistan alone, there were more than 2,000 robots fighting alongside American forces, and that force was rapidly expanding in number and intelligence. So Robert continued his weapons research here. The facility was perfectly suited for that, isolated, under a no-fly restriction, and best of all, surrounded by varied terrain. Rivers, forests, meadows, and cliffs. The perfect landscape to field test the various iterations of his neuropods. Now, with the loss of that major facility in Dubai, life was again returning to these empty halls. New priests were returning to the cathedral, ready to bring the chorus and the chant of the scientific method back to these hallowed halls. Robert should have been happier, but all he felt was dead inside. The loss of his brother coming so soon on the heels of Amanda's death, and now the threat to his grandnephew, it finally broke something inside him. Or maybe he had always been broken, and it took the blood of Jimmy on his hands for him to finally recognize it. The Bloodline had not been kind to its family. He planned on ending that today. The guard came back online. "Sir, orange and blue are negative on the target." "Then spread the search on foot. Scour every room, closet, and cabinet." "Yes, sir." Robert knew that could be a challenge. With the 4th of July holiday, only a skeleton staff remained on site. Not that the regular staff was all that much more fleshed out. But he needed his grandnephew returned to him. He'd lost too much today, and placed a thin hope that he could save the child and the straggling remnants of his immediate family. But with the outside world closing down upon his private world, he had no chance until he first secured the child. He knew what he needed. Leverage. He tapped a key and brought up a view of a cell in the red zone. A woman with a shaved head sat on a bed, her face in her hands. He was glad she was turned away. Robert pressed an intercom button. "Yes?" Dr. Fielding answered from his laboratory in that same zone. "Emmett, you said you wanted to test the newest pods, a more vigorous challenge of their abilities." Excitement frosted his voice. "Of course, sir." "Then let's get started." Robert finished with the man and made the necessary calls. Once done, he tapped another switch, accessing a camera that required a code known only to him. None must know about this prisoner. The view of another room bloomed onto the screen, only this one was lavishly appointed with a four-poster bed, deep cushioned chairs, a stone fireplace, and walls decorated with tapestries, The roof was wood-beamed, framed into Gothic arches, and supported a centuries-old crystal chandelier. But the room was still a cell. The window, streaming with sunlight, was heavily barred. The stout wood door, banded in iron, was locked electronically. The prisoner must have heard the stir of the camera as Robert turned it toward the window. She stood limned against the sunlight, a dark shadow, a slender twist against the brightness. Noting the camera's motion, she came forward, looking up. She still wore the same leathers as when she arrived, though it looked like she'd used the neighboring bathroom to shower. She glared up at the camera. Those green eyes, pinched slightly at the corner, marked her mixed Eurasian blood. Just the sight of those eyes made his heart clutch. He touched the screen with his finger, rubbing an edge of his thumb along the side of her face, knowing he could never get closer. She had escaped the guild years ago, turned enemy to the bloodline, but now she was returned to the fold. "Where you belong," he whispered throatily. "I should never have let you escape." Another face blinked into existence in the corner of the screen, irritating him with the interruption. "Mr. Gant," the man said, "I wanted to inform you that the helicopter is inbound with the package from D.C. "Acknowledged. I'll be back at the lodge momentarily." An underground tunnel ran from the lab complex to a secure entrance at the mansion. He could take the tram and be back there in minutes. He lingered a moment more, staring at his handsome prisoner. As if sensing his eyes, she lifted an arm and raised an offending finger toward the camera. He smiled as he clicked off the camera. He turned around and headed for the tunnel back to the lodge, ready to face the man who had killed his brother. 2:03 p.m. As the helicopter swept in a wide curve, Gray gaped at the view of the Gant family mansion below. He had seen pictures of the massive structure in books, never in person. Few people had. It competed with such great American castles as those built by the Vanderbilt, Rockefeller, and Hearst families. But the Gant clan went old school, patterning their design on a famous Crusader castle in Syria, the Croc de Chevalier, the Fortress of the Knights. Its outer wall, studded with small square towers and peppered with arrow slits, was 3 meters thick. The only passage through that wall was a massive archway, fronted by a drawbridge over a real moat. Beyond the wall, a sunlit courtyard was half parking lot, half gardens, holding centuries-old oaks and flowering rose beds. The keep itself had 70 rooms, all done in Gothic style of pointed arches, high windows, and a multitude of doors and balconies. It all led up to 2 square towers crowned by toothed parapets. The chopper lowered toward a helipad in the courtyard. As it dropped within the outer walls, Gray felt the world close in, trapping him. The skids touched the pavement, and he was led out at gunpoint, his wrists cuffed behind him. The team leader marched him across the courtyard toward the giant arched doors to the main mansion. Gray had nowhere to run. Even if he could escape, he remained tethered electronically to the transmitter in the leader's pocket. If he fled farther than 10 yards, the countdown to detonation would begin again. Right now, he needed to keep his head, in more ways than one. A few steps away, the team leader held his radio earpiece, listening to someone. His other hand nervously scratched at the crucifix tattoo on his neck. All Gray heard was a final, "Yes, sir." The man turned to Gray. "Come with me." They headed up the steps of native fieldstone and through an open wooden door carved with the panels depicting knightly pursuits, from jousting to battles. Beyond the door opened a massive hall. It was like stepping into a cathedral, from the vaulted ceilings to the massive stone pillars. Sunlight flowed through stained glass windows, again depicting knights, but in a more courtly setting, many wearing the Templar cross on their surcoats. Despite all of the grandness, there remained an indescribable warmth to the hall. Thick rugs softened the stone floors. Two fireplaces at either end, tall enough to trot horses through, promised merry winter fires. Even now, they were filled with massive bouquets, scenting the room with summer's endless promise. And Gray could tell where the nickname for the estate, the Lodge, came from. The mansion's reputation as a hunting lodge was plain. Several of the rugs on the floor were bearskins. Mounted on the walls were the heads of beasts from every continent. Hemingway would have been very happy here. "Keep up," the team leader barked. Gray hurried forward, led across the hall to a door beside one of the fireplaces. The leader knocked.
"Come in."
Gray was ushered into a small library, done up as a sitting room, with French antique furniture, a small fireplace, and tiny windows, no bigger than arrow slits, offering peeks at the gardens beyond. The lone occupant sat in a chair to one side of the cold fireplace. He wore a conservative gray suit, though he'd shed his jacket and had it folded over the edge of a chair. The white shirt was unbuttoned at the top, sleeves rolled up. Robert Gant held out his hand. The team leader rushed forward, passed the transmitter into his palm, along with the keys to Gray's cuffs, then hurried out, clearly under specific orders, as not a word was exchanged between them. The door closed. The president's brother stared at Gray's face and spoke his first words.
"Did he suffer?"
Gray didn't need to be told the subject of that question. Still, he didn't know his footing here. This was made worse by the fire in his chest, flaming the edges of his eyes, burning at the bonds of his self-control. But cuffed and at the mercy of the transmitter, he could do nothing but stand, his legs trembling with a desire to send him charging, regardless of the consequences. His fists tightened so hard that the bulge of his wrists cut into the tight cuffs. Robert waved him to the other chair opposite the fireplace. Gray took it, not trusting his control. He sat on the edge, ready to lunge, to exact whatever revenge he could upon the man responsible for his mother's death. Robert asked again, his voice cracking this time.
"Please. I know Jimmy's surgery's futile. I heard the grim prognosis, but in those final moments, did my brother suffer?"
Gray heard the pain more than the words. That keen of grief let him see past the red haze to the man's barely contained agony. Robert's eyes were stitched with red veins, shadowed darkly by pain, his skin as ashen as his gray jacket. For some reason, as much as he hated the man, Gray answered as truthfully as he could.
"No, your brother didn't suffer."
Robert nodded, turning to stare at his lap.
"Thank you for that."
The man sat quietly in that stricken pose for a long time. When he lifted his face again, tears ran down his face. He wiped them away and stared at the cold fireplace as if needing its warmth. He spoke his next word softly.
"I'm sorry for your mother."
Gray stiffened, coming close to leaping out of his chair. But the face the man showed Gray, so honestly distraught, quelled his anger.
"Loss is an affliction that never lets go of your heart. I know that too well. It is too high a price, even for life everlasting, which now seems a horrible thing."
Gray remembered Seishan saying something similar. What was going on with this man? He had expected torture and interrogations upon landing here. His only hope was that Painter had gotten his secret message and understood enough to figure out where he'd been taken.
"The accumulation of grief over one lifetime is more than a heart can bear," Robert explained. "Only the heartless could withstand more. Or the very young, those too naive to truly understand loss. Like I was when they came for me."
"When who came for you?" Gray asked, trying to understand. Robert remained silent, seeming to be working through something, clearly teetering on the edge. I'll show you. You may be useful to my plans. He stood and drew Gray after him. He crossed to a bookcase and pulled a handle tucked into the frame to unlatch a secret door. A section of the case swung open, revealing a spiral stone stair going down. Robert led the way, lit by wall sconces. Gray had expected cobwebs and wall torches, but the passage merely wound down to basement levels. Through the open doors to other landings, he saw laundry facilities, kitchens, and they ended up in a wine cellar. Arched tunnels carved out of the natural stone spread outward in multiple directions, dimly lit by bare bulbs strung above. Massive oak barrels lined both sides. Neighboring rooms, like small chapels dedicated to Bacchus, held towering racks of dusty bottles, an accumulation of unimaginable wealth. Robert moved swiftly forward, as if fearing he might change his mind or someone might stop him. Gray got dragged behind, as much by the pull of his invisible leash as by curiosity. Their journey ended deep within the vintner's maze, in a side room holding four massive French oak barrels, as large as elephants. Robert stepped to one and released a latch to open the face of the barrel. The wooden barrel was lined by steel. Robert hopped inside, followed by Gray. The back of the barrel looked like the doors to a bank vault. Robert typed in a code on the front and placed his hand on a palm reader. Green lights flashed, and a low hum of hydraulics rotated a 2-foot-thick plate steel door. It opened to a small room. An elevator, he realized as Robert entered more codes and the cage began to drop. During this entire trip, Robert hadn't said anything. He looked beyond words at the moment, lost in his own grief. Finally, the elevator stopped. The doors opened into an anteroom to a massive, hermetically sealed clean room, half the length of a football field. But this was no sterile, industrial, white and stainless steel place. Beyond the airlocked, sealed door was something out of the British Museum. Mahogany display cases held dusty tomes, yellowed scrolls, and worn artifacts from every age of man. Domes of glass sat atop marble plinths, protecting delicate statues and golden treasures. Robert turned to him. Within lies the true heart of the bloodline. Chapter 37. July 4th, 2:07 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Blue Ridge Mountains. Lisa crouched in a dark bathroom stall, perched on a toilet, with the baby cradled on her lap. She clutched a Langenbeck amputation knife in one fist. She had found the weapon, which looked like a scalpel with a 4-inch blade, in a necropsy lab. The morgue, like much of this labyrinthine facility, looked long deserted. A layer of fine dust had covered everything. She knew she couldn't stow herself in one of the body cabinets. Her footprints were plain on the dusty floor. To hide her tracks, she had kept her flight along the edge of the occupied sections of the laboratory. A dangerous path. She'd come close to being discovered twice, but the facility was a huge warren of hiding places. She had passed one corridor that must have run the length of the facility. Its end dwindled down to a dark point, lit only in a few sections. Within the first few minutes, she knew she must be underground. No windows anywhere. I need to find a way back to the surface. If she could escape, go for help, then she could offer Kat real support. By herself, any rescue attempt was futile. Her ankle continued to throb, shooting pain up her leg with every step. And it wasn't just Kat's life in danger. The baby slept in the crook of her arm, quiet as a lamb, belly full of milk, likely still bodily exhausted from the near-death collapse of his systems. She prayed the child remained quiet. She had come to this bathroom only as a temporary reprieve, to collect her thoughts. Her initial flight had been that of a panicked rabbit, just trying to stay ahead of the hunting pack. For the moment, she had lost her pursuers, arriving at a region of the facility with yellow walls. The whole facility seemed to be color-mapped. She'd fled from white through orange to yellow. She pictured Cat's cell. It had red walls. She had discovered an evacuation map outside the bathroom. It was that discovery that changed her course from a maddened flight to the beginnings of a plan. She ducked inside here to think, to go over, in her head, the route to take. From the evacuation plan, she recognized that she was on the middle level of three, somewhere in the northwest quadrant. The map laid out the shortest route up to the surface, but she dared not take that path. They would be expecting that. Likely guards were already posted. When she reached the next stairwell, they'd expect her to go up, so instead she would go down. She noted that the red zone on the map didn't extend to the third level. She saw a corridor that transected the facility, passing under the red zone. She could use that passageway to cross to the far side of the facility, where fewer eyes, if any, would be watching. There was a remote exit in a sliver of the lab that poked out from the bulk. That was her goal. She shifted a cramping leg toward the floor, wanting to check that map one more time, then begin her painful run for the exit. As her toe lowered toward the linoleum, the door to the bathroom creaked open. The light flicked on, blinding after her flight through the dim corridors and dark rooms. A casual whistling accompanied the intruder. Not likely a guard. From the timbre of the whistling and heavy-footed gait, it was a man. She prayed he crossed to the urinal, but his whistling approached the bay of stalls. She clutched her knife more tightly, willing him away. Not this one. Pick another. Her prayer was answered as he entered the neighboring stall, the one closest to the door. She had purposely avoided that one for that very reason. She would wait until he finished, give it another minute, then continue. It was at that moment, perhaps stirred by his whistling, that the boy in her arms began to stir, stretching a pudgy, wrinkled fist, yawning slightly. But she knew that wouldn't last. She had to get out of here before he made a noise and alerted her neighbor. She didn't know how long the man would be here. Her ears picked out the clatter of an unbuckling belt, the rip of a zipper, and soft shimmer of pants falling, followed by the long sigh of relief. It sounded like he'd be here a while. The whistling began again. Lisa couldn't take the risk of being trapped inside here if the baby began to cry. She carefully lowered her good foot to the ground, pivoted to her bad leg, careful of her ankle. She mouthed the blade between her lips and balanced the baby under the crook of one arm. Luckily, she had spent many nights babysitting Cat's children. She had never locked her stall. What would be the use? So she used the coat hook on the inside of the door to slowly swing it open, allowing her to slip outside. I can do this. Then the baby let out a small wail of complaint. Lisa froze as the whistling stopped. The stall lock snapped open. Her mind immediately flashed to her new mantra. WWKD. What would Cat do? Lisa kicked the door as it started to swing open, catching the man in the face as he reached forward. He fell back. Lisa followed, her knife already in hand. As he looked up, she slashed hard at his exposed throat. The razor-sharp amputation blade, made to cut through hard cartilage and stiff tendons, performed as designed. The deep cut severed skin, muscle, and trachea, drowning any scream. The severed carotid spurted high, splashing. The man gurgled and slid off of the commode. His hands clutched at his neck, his eyes shining with shock. Already dead, but not knowing it. That's what Cat would do. Lisa swung away, careful of the blood pooling so as not to leave tracks. She pulled the stall shut, crossed to the bathroom door, and turned off the lights. His absence would likely be missed. She had to be far away before that happened. She peeked out and found the hall clear, but as she stepped out, her name was called loudly, echoing through the facility. She cringed. But it was only the loudspeaker system. The voice was male, not the digitally masked speaker from earlier. It didn't sound like Robert Gant's southern slant, or Edward Blake's British accent. Someone knew. Dr. Lisa Cummings, this is your one and only warning. You will turn yourself and the child over to the nearest personnel, or you will send your friend into deadly peril.
A monitor bloomed to light down the hall. Others blinked elsewhere. Clearly, he was making a general broadcast to the entire compound. She shifted down the hall enough to see a stranger on the screen. He wore white laboratory coveralls with a hood pulled back and a surgical mask on top of his head. In the background, she spotted Dr. Blake. The view suddenly switched, revealing Kat standing at gunpoint beside a sealed metal door. It looked like she carried a length of pipe and a small shield of some sort.
As punishment and to understand the threat she faces, we will perform a small demonstration so you fully understand.
The door swung open, sunlight blazed, blinding the camera. The view switched to the outside, looking down upon a grassy meadow, a line of oaks in the distant background. Kat was shoved outside, stumbling into view, shading her eyes with her small shield against the summer glare.
Turn yourself in now, or her fate will worsen over time. This is your only warning.
Lisa needed no time to decide. WWKD. She knew what Kat would want her to do. She hurried down the hall, not to turn herself in, but to make her escape while most eyes here were fixed on those screens, prepared to enjoy whatever blood sport was about to ensue. And Lisa knew from the shield and the club that some gladiatorial battle was about to start. She caught fractured glimpses as she ran with the child, gone quiet again for now, likely jostled back to sleep by her running. In stuttered snatches, she saw Kat head out into that field, wading through the grasses.
Be careful, she wished her friend.
2:18 p.m. Kat stalked across the thigh-high grass. She carried a hard steel shield, 2 feet square, strapped to her forearm. In her other hand, she wielded a 3-foot length of hollow pipe. She breathed deeply, readying her body, flushing oxygen into her muscles. Her senses stretched out. The tall grass was mostly green, redolent of summer, the scent growing stronger as she crushed through blades with her slippers. The edges of her gown snagged on bristled weeds. Her ears caught the twitter of birdsong, registering it but filtering it into the background, along with the distant sound of tumbling water to the northwest and the sweep of gentle wind through leaves. She knew the hunters would be coming. She'd overheard the two scientists talking, Fielding and Blake, preparing her, deciding which weapons to test.
The battlefield is the ultimate crucible of Darwinian natural selection, Fielding had explained to the other researcher. Survival is the main drive of evolution, and it's no different for our pods. For our weapons to learn, they must be field-tested, battle-hardened. With each new challenge, new synapses of the cybernetic brains will grow and expand, but we must test the pods with ever harder challenges.
She had seen those hexapods, as she heard them called. Crab-like titanium killing machines, equipped with razor-sharp legs, slashing daggers, and drilling burrs. Other variants lined the workbench. The worst looked like a large bloated tick, its legs as skinny as ice picks. Beyond the workbench, deeper in the lab, larger creatures, the size of small black bears, had lurked in various stages of assembly. Kat strode across the meadow, hefting the shield to test its weight, and swinging the pipe to judge its balance.
We've pitted the hexapods against unarmed opponents in the past, Fielding had finished. Today we'll test them against the next level of weaponry, blunt weapons and shields. We will send wave after wave, escalating the numbers each time until they learn, adapt, and defeat their opponent.
A rustle to her left alerted her. She swung around, dropping her shield low. The grasses stirred as something raced low through them, cutting across the meadow like the fin of a shark through water. She saw 4 other trails swinging wider, intending to outflank and circle her. Clearly, they were capable of coordination. Good to know. Fast as greyhounds, the hexapods churned through the fields. She'd never make it to the tree line, so she didn't bother trying. Across the meadow like the fin of a shark through water.
she saw four other trails swinging wider, intending to outflank and circle her. Clearly, they were capable of coordination. Good to know. Fast as greyhounds, the hexapods churned through the fields. She'd never make it to the tree line, so she didn't bother trying. She would make her stand here, using this first wave, if she survived it, to learn and adapt. Nothing said she couldn't evolve as readily as her opponents. First, she didn't want to be in deep grass. She wanted a better field of view. With seconds to spare, she used her shield as a press and stamped a swath of grass around her, pushing the stalks outward, creating a thicker natural palisade. She left one section open, a gate into her little nest. The first hexapod hit that palisade broadside, got wedged in the wall of compacted grasses. She identified the gleam of its titanium carapace and speared her pipe down at it, using all of her weight. Metal crunched under the battering ram. It didn't kill the beast, but it incapacitated its sensory system, sending the pod zipping away in a spiraling, blind curve. The other four, perhaps wirelessly sharing the experience of the first, veered away from a direct attack. They swarmed in a circle. Then one cut away, shooting toward the opening, sensing the chink in her shield, not knowing it was a trap. It cut into her nest, but she was ready. She used her pipe like a golf club and batted it square in the front sensors, crushing the electronics and sending it flying. It landed on its back and didn't move. A weak spot. The other three circled, clearly plotting something. Then, once decided, the trio arrowed toward the opening together, plainly trying to overwhelm her. "Sorry, we're closed for the day." She slammed her shield's edge into the soft loam, sealing the opening to her nest. The lead pod hit the shield with a loud clank. She stabbed downward again and again, like a piston. She shattered most of its legs, leaving it crippled. The other two veered away, plotting their next move. Cat wasn't waiting. She found a fist-sized rock and underhanded it into the grasses. The movement drew one of the creatures. It shot in that direction, but it was only fooled for a few seconds. Once the rock stopped moving, it stopped hunting. It knew the rock wasn't alive. The test confirmed the hexapods had motion sensors, but they must be backed by infrared, reading body heat, a mark of living creatures. Since the pod chased the rock, she doubted its visual acuity was very sharp. They could be fooled. What about sound and smell? The two pods didn't give her another chance to find out. They zoomed in from opposite directions, one headed toward the shield, the other, the natural grassy palisade. Cat snatched her shield back up, opening her nest again, allowing the first one to shoot inside. The second got delayed, trying to push itself through the grass, employing some buzzing blade to chop into her space. The first spun on a dime and came at her. She shoulder-dropped, putting all her weight on the edge of her shield, turning it into a guillotine. She crushed the front end, driving it into the soft soil. The second burst through the palisade, leading its charge with a spinning horizontal saw blade. She leaped to the side as the second rammed the first, finishing the job for her with its diamond blade ripping open the underside of the other pod. The first retaliated in a defensive death reflex. Razor-sharp legs drilled into crevices, peeled open the carapace, and ripped out the glass-enclosed brain. In seconds, they'd killed each other. Cat crouched, examining their weaponry, peeking at the arsenal under their carapaces. She noted a small dart-like apparatus, the side marked with the designation M99. Etorphine hydrochloride. A powerful game animal tranquilizer. Strong enough that one drop could immobilize a man. Knowing her opponents better, she stood and stared over at the small bunker through which she'd exited the facility. She knew they were watching. She just glared. "Let's see what else you've got." She turned and sprinted for the tree line. 2:28 p.m. "She'll do well," Emmett Fielding said, forming a temple of his fingers before his lips, studying the bank of monitors. "Very fit." Edward sat beside him at the curved bank of computer screens. He gently fingered his broken nose, taped up after Lisa's surprise attack. He watched the woman flee out of the view of one camera and into another. She fled through a dark forest of oaks, pine, and spruce.
"Aren't you upset that she dispatched your weapon so quickly?" Edward asked.
A flap of fingers waved away his concern.
"You can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs.
Porsche destroys fleets of their sports cars in their testing lab and field trials. That's how you build the best. And I won't settle for anything less."
Edward had noted how the man's pulse beat faster in his throat during the attack. He suspected this testing was as much a blood sport to him as it was a science. But that wasn't his concern. After seeing that, surely Lisa would return with the boy.
"Any word?" Edward asked.
Fielding made a non-committal noise, plainly not interested. Whether Lisa showed up or not, he intended to continue this test until the woman on the screen was a macerated ruin. He glanced to the clock. Petra had also gone off on her own to search for Lisa. After being caught off guard and struck in the head, his research associate was out for blood, hunting as diligently and as coldly as those steel creatures. Fielding sat back from his workstation, stretching.
"I think we're ready for round two.
How many will you send this time?"
"A full score, I believe.
20.
But she's shown so much promise. Truly remarkable. I think we'll skip straight to the next level of challenge. Introducing a new element."
Fielding glanced behind him to the back of his lab. Larger pods hulked back there, on four limbs, curved into sloth-like gutting claws. Edward had seen how fast the quadrupods could move, bone-chillingly frightening to witness.
"I think I'll send up two," Fielding said, and tapped buttons with a bit of bravado.
Blake stared at the running woman. She had better hope Lisa changed her mind and returned with the child, though in the end it wouldn't make any difference. Not for either of the women. 2:29 p.m. Lisa fled down a long, dim corridor, the baby under one arm, the knife ready in the other. She had watched in fleeting glimpses Kat's successful battle with the metal creatures, but more to come had been promised, and she had no doubt it would be delivered. She glanced above her head. "I should be under the red zone by now." By her best estimate from the live feed, she was unfortunately fleeing in the opposite direction from Kat. She couldn't offer her friend any help, other than to survive herself. She continued down the corridor that transected the huge complex, passing through a zone designated as black. This area appeared empty, but not deserted. The air had a feeling of expectation to it, like before a lightning storm. The source appeared a few yards ahead. To the right opened a vast cathedral-sized warehouse. A full flight of steps led down to the lower floor. From up on top, Lisa had an expansive view of the space, a hangar large enough to park a commercial jet inside. The warehouse was full of more of those metal creatures, stacked in racks, or for the larger ones, resting on the floor. Cables ran to charging racks or directly into the backs of the four-legged ones. In the center, clearly still under construction, was a monster the size of a Pershing tank, a slumbering giant waiting to be awakened. A steady hum and the electrical smell of ozone radiated from the space, creating that sense of pending storm. The charge in the air stirred the hairs on the back of her neck. She hurried past with a sense of dread. The corridor finally ended. She took the stairs, picturing the map in her head. These steps led up to an exit off a spur of the main lab, hopefully leading to some forgotten backwater where she could slip away on foot. She crept up slowly, landing by landing, expecting a shout at any moment. She crossed past the middle level to the top floor. As she continued to the next step, leading up toward freedom, a loud voice echoed to her.
"Dr. Cummings, we are ready for round two."
Frightened, Lisa fled up the stairs. "I don't want to see." But she could still hear. Echoing up from below came the faint shift of machinery, the groan of hydraulics, accompanied by the sudden spike in electricity in the air. Forces were being mobilized against Kat.
Lisa reached the top of the stairs. A door appeared ahead with an emergency evacuation bar. She feared passing through it might set off some internal alarm, get eyes looking her way in this remote corner of the complex. But she had no other choice. If she remained below, it was only a matter of time until she and the child were discovered. I'd rather take my chances above than be trapped below. She shoved the bar, momentarily scared it wouldn't open. But it did. Bright sunlight flowed over her, stirring the child with its brightness. A chubby arm flailed against it. Along with the sunshine came a deafening roar. She stepped out of the bunker and faced a waterfall spilling over a 30-foot-high cliff. It crashed down to a river below her perch. She did a slow turn, realizing she'd come out on a narrow plateau framed by a frothing river on one side and towering cliffs on the other. There was no way up or down. A dead end. The baby started to cry, soft wails becoming loud ones, echoing off the cliff wall. She didn't blame him. We're trapped.
Chapter 38. July 4th, 2:25 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Blue Ridge Mountains. Within lies the true heart of the bloodline. Gray pondered those words as he stood at the threshold of the sealed museum space.
I was first brought here when I was a boy, Robert explained. I was too naive to understand the true cost of the knowledge inside, of the blood pact that it would require of me, of the losses I would have to endure.
Two symbols etched on the glass flanked either side of the airlock door. To the right was a cross, emblazoned with spirals of DNA. Gray had seen that symbol before, enough to know Robert was not lying about the importance of this space. To the left was the same cross, only it was decorated with entwining snakes. Robert noted his attention. He touched the cross with the snakes.
This was our past. The other is our future.
Without further explanation, Robert unsealed the airlock and brought Gray into the room. Lights flickered on, revealing a neighboring clean room branching off from this chamber. Gray spotted towering banks of black mainframes back there, but Robert drew him onward. Still, Gray's eyes drifted hungrily to the computer room. What do those massive servers hold? Apparently, such questions would have to wait. Their destination stood at the very back of the museum space. A tall glass case held a single nondescript object. An upright wooden staff. Curious, sensing the palpable age of the artifact, Gray leaned closer, his arms still cuffed behind him. Upon the surface of the staff, three serpents had been faintly carved, winding around and around the shaft in a complicated tangle.
What is it? Gray asked, straightening back up. An artifact discovered by an ancestor of mine during the Crusades, found in a citadel atop a mountain in Galilee. It is called the Bacalisa. It was the staff carried by St. Patrick.
Gray turned to him.
The saint who chased the snakes out of Ireland?
Exactly. But do you know the staff's history? How St. Patrick came to possess it?
Gray shook his head.
Robert explained. The legend goes that when Patrick was returning from Rome on his way back to Ireland, he stopped at the island of Genoa. There he met a young man who claimed to have received the staff from a pilgrim of sweet and majestic countenance, and was told to hold it until my servant Patrick rests here on his way to Erin for the conversion of its people and give it into his hands when he quits you. This caretaker also claimed that while the staff was in his possession, he had stopped aging, living over a century as he waited for Patrick.
Gray eyed the historical artifact skeptically.
A staff that grants immortality?
According to the lore of St. Patrick, that pilgrim was Jesus Christ.
Gray stared at the simple staff with both awe and not a small amount of disbelief.
Do you believe that?
I don't know. But there are other stories that claim this staff is much older, said to have been possessed by King David, and before that, by Moses. Quite the pedigree, Gray thought to himself, not wanting to offend or stop this recitation. The longer the story took, the more time Painter had to solve the riddle Gray had left behind in D.C. Plus, the man's prior words kept him attentive. You may be useful to my plans. The words hadn't sounded like a threat, more like a pact. He let the man talk. Who knows if any of that is true, Robert admitted. The one who found this was a Templar knight, hence the cross that decorates our symbol. According to that story, the staff was in the possession of a guardian claiming to be over 500 years old. She stole that staff, slaying that man. Wait, she? Yes, she was a Templar, one of the original nine, though her name was stricken from the historical record after her discovery. That moment was our ancestors' greatest triumph and our most bitter failure. But I'm jumping ahead of myself. Then go on. Upon her return to France with the stolen staff, it became apparent, though it took years, that the staff bore no miraculous properties. So it didn't hold the secret to immortality. Robert eyed him. No, it did. But it would take centuries for us to discover the truth. For it wasn't the staff that was the miracle. It was the knowledge written on it. Gray squinted at the staff. The three snakes? Robert shifted him to an old, illuminated Bible resting open on a stand, the pigments brilliant under the lights. Snakes are a common religious theme, he said. Patrick cast out the serpents of Ireland. Moses turned his staff into a snake. But it's the earlier story of the serpent from the book of Genesis that revealed the truth. There were two trees in the Garden of Eden. The tree of life, which bore the fruit of immortality, and the tree of knowledge. God cast out Adam and Eve after they ate from the tree of knowledge because he feared with that knowledge they would take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. But the tree of life is just symbolic. That's not true. It existed. Or at least it did in the past. What are you talking about? There are plenty of stories in the Bible of people living to incredible ages, the most famous being Methuselah, who lived 969 years. But there are many others, and not just in the Bible. The clay tablets of Babylon and Sumer claim their kings lived to incredible ages, centuries upon centuries. But those ages are just allegorical, not the literal truth. Perhaps, except the story of a plant that sustains life is not limited to the Bible. In the ancient epic of Gilgamesh, the hero of that story hunts for the plant of life, a plant that grants immortality. Robert pointed to another case, this one holding old books. In the ancient Hindu Vedic scriptures, they describe a plant called Soma, with the same properties. We've quaffed the Soma bright and are immortal grown. He moved next to a plate of Egyptian art, showing a falcon-headed god plucking leaves from a tall plant. Here is an actual depiction of the tree of life from Egyptian mythology. Robert turned to look across the breadth of artifacts. There are many other examples, but what's unusual about all these stories is one detail. In the Bible, Noah is the last person to live such incredible ages. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, the adventuring king discovers the plant he seeks has been drowned away. In both those stories and many others, this life-sustaining plant is destroyed by a great flood. Robert turned back to Gray. Maybe this is just a coincidence, but maybe there was a seed of truth to these stories. And from that seed, a new tree of life could be grown. That's what the bloodline came to believe. For centuries, they've searched for the meaning of those three snakes, sensing there was some significance to it that was tied to immortality. They were confident enough to incorporate those snakes into their own symbol. Robert pointed back to the glass doors. And it wasn't just our mark. We left that fingerprint everywhere, hoping to draw out those with hidden knowledge. My ancestors believed so firmly in that connection that they incorporated that symbol into the various secret organizations that hid us. He led Gray over to an open page of a book of Masonic rites. It showed three men clasping hands, entwined very much like the snakes on the staff. And if there was any doubt, the snakes were depicted there, too, with three heads. "So you see how steadfastly we believed," Robert said. "And in the end, we were proven right."
"Right? How?"
"The drawing on the staff was knowledge encoded for future generations. Genetic knowledge." Robert pointed to the other symbol on the door. "That's where the symbol got changed, transforming the snakes into what they really represented. Strands of DNA."
"You're saying that ancients in the past knew enough about DNA to encode it as snakes on a staff?"
"Possibly. Back in the 60s, a scientist named Hayflick determined that man's natural age could not exceed 120 years. He based that on the number of times a cell could divide."
"I'm familiar with the Hayflick limit," Gray said, having studied biophysics.
"Then is it mere coincidence that the book of Genesis came to the same conclusion about the limits to a man's lifetime? To quote from that book of the Bible, his days shall be 120 years. The same conclusion as Hayflick. Where did that knowledge come from?"
"Okay, that's strange, I admit. But that's a far cry from saying that the snakes on the staff represent strands of DNA. There are three snakes drawn there. DNA is a double helix."
"Ah, but there's the rub. The secret of immortality doesn't lie within two strands, but three. A triple helix. That's what is written on the staff. It took until the modern age, with the aid of DNA analysis, for us to unravel that mystery."
"How did you do that?"
"When our errant knight left with the staff, she killed the previous immortal who possessed it, likely the last of his kind. She spilled his blood, which was preserved on the staff. In his blood, we discovered his white cells possessed triple helical DNA."
This sharpened Gray's attention.
"Triple helical DNA?"
He was beginning to appreciate the enormity of the revelation here.
Robert nodded. "Once genetic science advanced enough to let us decode that third strand, we determined it was actually a viral protein from a plant virus. The protein was a natural form of peptide nucleic acid, PNA. It infected human cells after someone ate that plant. A side effect of this virus leaping from plant to animal was that it stabilized cells, staved off cellular degeneration, and extended the lifespans of the infected dramatically."
Gray pictured the Garden of Eden.
"The mythical tree of life." "Maybe not so mythical after all. But I thought you said the plant's fields were drowned during the Great Flood. How did this guardian come to possess it?"
"Apparently, someone had the foresight to stockpile some of the plants, drying them out like tea leaves. From the chronicles of the knight who stole the staff, written on her deathbed, she described a row of Egyptian sarcophagi full of brittle leaves and stems in the crypt. Focused on her goal, she didn't think anything about it, and left it all to burn."
Gray appreciated the irony.
"So, like the Eve of old, your knight stole the Tree of Knowledge, bringing you this cryptic clue about immortality, but she left behind the Tree of Life."
"So it seems. In the end, we tried to reverse engineer that viral